the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Good morning and thanks for joining us today on Farm City Newsday. In a California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News report, a tiny wasp shows promise in controlling a giant weed along California riverbanks. Biologists say the wasp can help reduce strands of the Arundo reed that has invaded watersheds. The wasp is native to the Mediterranean region and lays its eggs on the reed, ultimately reducing its growth. Researchers introduced the wasps near Orland and Madera, and they say they have some effect on the reeds. The wasps do not harm humans, crops, or native plants. Moving on to what's happening in today's show, Brian German is talking with us about new Food and Farm Facts book available from the American Farm Bureau Federation. You'll hear about rotating insecticides to combat resistance. Taylor Hillman has details on a wordage change in Assembly Bill 1805. And I'm starting off the show today with news on the U.S.-Japan trade agreement. So let's jump right in. The U.S. and Japan have agreed to a trade deal. What are the next steps before it takes action? The Japan trade agreement with the United States was said to be looked at as an early harvest one. One that was straight to the point, covering tariff reductions and in some cases elimination, as well as market access. Here is Deputy Secretary Steven Sinski breaking down what comes next in implementation.
The next steps, the legal teams from both sides are going to be doing the normal lawyerly scrubs of the language and making all the making sure it's all the key terms are being reflected appropriately. And that's going to happen over the next couple of weeks. The Japanese Diet needs to approve this. And my understanding is they're going to move very, very quickly within the next week or so to take action to approve that. Here on the U.S. side, we do not need to have congressional approval of this agreement because this is being taken. The tariff reductions that the U.S. is providing to Japan are being done under some of the authorities that the president already has and U.S. trade representative has already. And so we don't have to wait for congressional approval. And then those steps are going to lead to implementation just as quickly as possible at the beginning of the year.
And now for more agriculture news with Taylor Hillman.
A newly signed law will change reportable incidents for employers, and those wording changes will increase exposure reports. Governor Gavin Newsom recently signed AB 1805. The wording changes in the law will increase the amount of incidents that will need to be reported to Cal OSHA. The law takes the 24-hour minimal hospital time stipulation off for reporting accidents altogether, and AgSafe's Amy Wolf said exposure incident reporting requirements are also changing with very slight differences in the new definition.
What they've done is, it's a nuanced language change. Previously, if that exposure led to a substantial possibility that death or serious physical harm could occur, it qualified as a serious exposure. Substantial has now been replaced with realistic. And so, realistic is a lower threshold than substantial. And so what we expect to see is the number of cases where individuals have had exposure to hazardous substances. Again, larger pool of individuals by dropping that threshold from substantial down to realistic.
Reporting for AgNet West Radio Network, I'm Taylor Hillman.
Alternating between insecticides instead of mixing may be a better approach for combating resistance among pests. At the recent alfalfa and forage field day at Kearney Ag Center, cooperative extension specialist with UC Davis, Ian Grettenberger, noted that insecticide resistance in alfalfa weevil has been a growing issue in recent years and explained that theory doesn't always hold true to practice when it comes to insecticide applications.
Generally, when we talk about insecticides, as entomologists compared to weed scientists, we're recommending rotating insecticides versus mixing insecticides. Generally, that's a better practice. Oftentimes, the assumptions that would hold true for mixing insecticides to prevent resistance often don't hold up in the field versus in theory, and so that's generally why we recommend rotating insecticides for each successive generation of the given pest.
For AgNet West Radio Network, I'm Brian German. The new Food and Farm Facts book, Map and Pocket Guide, produced by the American Farm Bureau Foundation for Agriculture, are now available. The 32-page full-color book features updated facts and easy-to-read infographics that can be used in a variety of ways to help increase agricultural literacy. Each copy of the book includes a color abundant agriculture poster mapping out the top agricultural products produced in every state. The book can be a valuable resource in the classroom, at fairs and events, and for student leadership organizations. Additional food and farm facts resources created by the foundation will be available later this fall, including classroom activity cards developed using national learning criteria and state Common Core standards. American Farm Bureau Federation President Zippy Duval said, quote, "Food and Farm Facts provides the opportunity to share the story of agriculture, how and why farmers and ranchers do what they do to produce food, fiber, and renewable fuel." For AgNet West Radio Network, I'm Brian German.
The law says every U.S. meat and poultry slaughter and processing plant like this one cannot operate without Agriculture Department food and food safety inspectors present. This month, the USDA is having events in Iowa and Wisconsin to try to recruit and hire new inspectors.
Because we do have a vacancy rate that we're trying to reduce.
Carmen Rottenberg runs the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service. She says the need is so great for inspectors that the Federal Office of Personnel Management has just given her agency so-called direct hire authority, which basically cuts some of the bureaucracy involved in federal hiring. She says normally it takes 4 to 6 months to get somebody hired and on board.
And this potentially can cut that in half, at least in half.
So who can qualify for a food inspector job?
We're looking for people who have had at least 1 year of experience in a meat or poultry establishment setting, or individuals who have a college degree in any of the agricultural sciences.
For more information, go to usajobs.gov, usajobs.gov. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
One of the major challenges facing the cannabis industry has been the ability to work with banks. That may change, however, as legislation moves forward that will allow cannabis-related businesses access to banking institutions. The Secure and Fair Enforcement Act of 2019, known as the Safe Banking Act, was recently passed by the House of Representatives by a vote of 321 to 103. Banking institutions can potentially face criminal and civil liability for providing services to cannabis businesses under some banking statutes. The Safe Banking Act looks to allow federally insured banks to work with cannabis businesses and other ancillary companies in states that have legalized marijuana without risk of prosecution. State-approved cannabis businesses are operating primarily on a cash basis, which creates a significant risk for theft and encourages the potential for tax evasion and money laundering. Supporters of the bill note that for a truly regulated and administered cannabis industry to function properly, the companies need access to financial institutions. While the bill received fairly bipartisan support in the House, it's unclear how the Senate will be voting. The Senate banking chairman indicated an intention to have the Senate vote on the Safe Banking Act before the end of the year. For AgNet West Radio Network, I'm Brian German.
Well, in today's livestock news, the World Trade Organization announced the size of the retaliatory tariffs on EU goods that the U.S. may levy in response to the illegal EU subsidies to Airbus. These tariffs may continue until the EU brings its policies into compliance with WTO rules. And following that announcement, the National Milk Producers Federation issued a statement noting subsidies and barriers that handicap U.S. businesses in the global marketplace by violating international trade commitments should not be tolerated, and we strongly support the World Trade Organization's imposition of $7.5 billion in retaliatory duties on European products, including dairy foods, to prod the EU to uphold its World Trade Organization commitments and reinforce the importance of two-way trade. NMPF strongly endorses the U.S. Trade Representative's new list of European dairy exports that will now face higher tariffs, including cheeses, yogurt, and butter. The release said the U.S. is running a $1.6 billion dairy trade deficit with Europe because of unfair EU trade practices that block our access to their market while they enjoy broad access to ours. Well, the Department of Agriculture this week did reopen the public comment period for the National Organic Program Origin of Livestock proposed rule. First introduced back in 2015, the proposal would add requirements about transitioning dairy animals to organic production. Current regulations provide two tracks for replacing dairy animals, which are tied to how dairy farmers transition to organic production. Now, the proposed action would eliminate the two-track system and also require that upon transition, all existing and replacement dairy animals from which milk or milk products are intended to be sold, labeled, or represented as organic must be managed organically from the last third of gestation. The National Organic Program received over 1,500 public comments during the original comment period back in 2015. USDA will consider all public comments in developing a final rule, including those in 2015 and the new comment period. The current comment period will close on December 2nd of this year. And we told you yesterday that Ag Secretary Cindy Perdue had expressed surprise at the lower-than-expected number of dairy producers who did not sign up for the new Dairy Margin Coverage, or DMC, program this year. But according to the National Milk Producers Federation, more than 22,000 dairy farmers did sign up, which is more than the number who participated in the last year of the Margin Protection Program. And the new DMC paid out more than $302 million in its first year. NMPF says that's $302 million more than what farmers would have received under the MPP, which would actually have cost farmers money in 2019. Monthly milk price feed cost margins so far this year have been above the $8 per hundredweight coverage cutoff that existed under MPP, but below the new $9.50 per hundredweight coverage limit under the new DMC. Wisconsin signed up the largest number of farmers, while California enrolled the highest production volume of any state. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
In more agriculture news, when it comes to food portions, should value be determined by volume or by nutritional quality? USDA Stephanie Ho has the answer in this report.
Stephanie Fu is a senior policy advisor at USDA's Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion. She has a comment about portion sizes.
So a lot of times the American consumer thinks about value being getting as much as possible for as little money. And that usually means volume, as much food as possible.
Instead, she says,
how do we add a new dimension to the word value and help people think about value in terms of getting the most good stuff, good nutrition, into every bite?
This is one of the ideas that her office is promoting with groups like the Portion Balance Coalition, a cross-sector group that is fighting obesity.
It's not trying to talk about portion and the importance of it in a way that makes people feel like they're being deprived, right?
She says she wants people to eat healthier but enjoy their food at the same time. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
Let's go back to the year this song was a big hit.
You're the clock.
It was 1935. The U.S. population, about 120 million people. We had about 7 million farms, so about one farm for every 17 of us. Most Americans had some connection to a farm and to agriculture. However, fast forward to the present. We only have 2 million farms, but 320 million people, or one farm for every 160 of us. So over the years, our connection to agriculture
has gradually become more distant, more and more distant, generation after generation, so that today most of us have no physical or intellectual connection with agriculture at all.
Now, this may not seem like a problem, but with fewer and fewer lawmakers and policymakers with any background as to what farmers go through to produce our food, decisions can be made that create unintended problems for farmers. And this lack of connection with farms also can cause many kids and adults not to incorporate farm fresh raised fruits and vegetables into their diets. And so, to remedy all that, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has what is called the Farm to School program.
To teach kids about the importance of learning where their food comes from, how it's developed.
Deputy Undersecretary of Agriculture Brandon Lips, this is a program in which schools apply for grants to start farm-to-school programs. Brandon Lips is just back now from New Orleans, where he spoke to the people who were awarded this year's grants.
We have to develop generations of kids who know where their food comes from because they understand the importance of and the difficulty in agriculture.
So they grow and appreciate the work farmers go through to bring us food. Maybe it's a little like gold.
In this classic movie, The Treasure of Sierra Madre, an old prospector played by Walter Huston tries to explain to Humphrey Bogart,
why is gold worth some 20 bucks an ounce?
I don't know.
The gold, mister, is worth what it is because of the human labor that went into the finding and the getting of it.
Same with food, in a way. So kids in schools that have farm-to-school programs learn all about the labor and the science that goes into producing food. And while in New Orleans, Brandon Lips visited some schools that are running farm-to-school programs.
We had a wonderful opportunity to sit down with a handful of those kids who talked about the new fruits and vegetables that they've learned to try.
We try out different fruits and vegetables, so we get to vote if we like it, love it, or tried it.
Each one of them talked about an interest in a science and specifically plant-created career when they grow up.
I want to be a botanist.
Botanist?
I want to be a famous singer and also do gardening.
Which shows the effect that farm-to-school is having at this age in their life, but beginning in them an inspiration to change their lives for the long term.
Lips says maybe some of these kids will be farmers or scientists who will figure out how we're going to produce the 50 to 70% more food that will be needed by 2050 as the world population grows. Oh, and we thank our longtime USDA colleague Leslie Langster for providing some of the audio for this report. In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Transforming compost into an effective liquid fertilizer tea. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Store-bought liquid fertilizer can be expensive, especially if you have a lot of plants to feed. Fortunately, there's a cost-effective, easy alternative you can brew up at home. Getting started with a home-brewed liquid fertilizer can be as simple as steeping compost in water for 24 hours, or it can be slightly more complex process. The best compost tea is made by aerating the tea during steeping. This part of the process will brew a stronger, more microbe-rich liquid fertilizer. You'll need a 5-gallon bucket filled with water, an aquarium air pump, and an air stone for aeration purposes, about a quarter cup of molasses, and finally a tea bag, which could be made out of a cheesecloth, adult-sized sock, or one leg of pantyhose filled with 1 gallon of dry compost. Add the molasses to your bucket of water. If you're not going to be aerating your tea, just use a stick to mix up the water and molasses a bit to help it dissolve. If you're aerating your tea, attach the aquarium pump and the air stone right after submerging your compost. Follow the pump directions, turn it on, and leave it running all 24 hours of tea steeping. After the 24 hours, turn off the pump and remove the compost bag. When compost tea is done brewing, it will have a rich, earthy scent. You shouldn't smell any foul odors. If yours smells like a trash can, don't use it. Aerated compost tea does have a short shelf life and should be used within 48 hours. I'm Kathy Isom for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. My recipe today isn't really a recipe for cooking, more of a recipe for drinking. This is my really amazing recipe for making a fresh lemonade. Let's get started. Now, the very first step to this lemonade is quality ingredients. Now, the thing is this, I understand the lemons are a little bit pricier than they normally are, and the limes are too, but guess what? My recipe calls for both. This is a fantastic lemonade. It's done so well. It tastes amazing, but more importantly, it's really just going to bring a smile to everybody's face. It's a really simple way of making a great, great lemonade. So what I need first in my pitcher is going to be 2 quarts of mineral water. I'm going to follow that up with 2 cups of fresh lemon juice, 1 cup of lime juice. Then we're going to take 4 sliced lemons. Slice them thin. I like them thin. It's beautiful because it's all about presentation as well. Kind of picture this, if you're going to be using this like at a picnic or a barbecue or something, and you're in charge of making the lemonade, you really want to bring some great lemonade. 2 sliced limes as well. You don't have to squeeze them in there or whatever. If you want to give them an extra squeeze for just a little bit more tartness, that's okay. Not a problem at all whatsoever. Finish this with 3 cups of sugar. Now, what I like to do is get this all mixed up. Now, you may be thinking, hey, chef, it's a little bit sweeter, it's a little bit more tart, but then we fill the whole thing up with ice. So realistically, what we have here is 1 gallon of lemonade, but only half of the gallon is going to be the actual lemonade. The other half is going to be with the ice. It's going to be
absolutely amazing. For this and many more of my untamed recipes, go to my website, www.ajhtheuntamedchef.com. And you can also email me from there. You can ask me questions. You can check out some of my cooking videos on there. We have so much wonderful content on there as well. And if you feel it's in your heart and you want to support us, my links there for PayPal. And I don't know if my Patreon link is on there, but I really don't care much for Patreon. I just want to help everybody be better in the kitchen. I'm Albert J. Hernandez, and you all know me as the Untamed Chef from AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. I'm Danielle Leal. For our interview segment today, we take a listen to a brand new agriculture podcast hosted by American Farm Bureau Federation President Zippy Duvall. In this first ever episode, Zippy talks with U.S. Secretary Sonny Perdue. The two of them joke about being Georgia farm boys and how it led them to Washington. Let's take a listen.
Hello, I'm Zippy Duvall, and I'm president of American Farm Bureau. But I'm first a farmer. A farmer from Georgia that spent my whole life milking cows as a child and as an adult, and answering the call to serve by becoming Farm Bureau president in Georgia, and ended up here as president of American Farm Bureau. And I want to introduce to you today, because I'm real excited to start a new venture in my journey here at American Farm Bureau, and that venture is through communicating through podcast. So welcome to Farmside Chat. Today on our inaugural show, I got the opportunity to sit down with Secretary Sonny Perdue in his office here in Washington, D.C., and we had a great time talking about our friendship and how our lives have evolved and led us to Washington, D.C., and we also got to talk a little bit about family and farming and our faith. So I hope you enjoy this conversation, because it surely was fun doing it. Well, Mr. Secretary, and I'm sure you don't really mind me calling you Sonny in this setting, and I just really appreciate you doing this with me this morning.
Zippy, that's what I respond to most. So I think Zippy and Sonny, we've had a lot of laughs about those two names up here.
We have. You know, the joke around town right after you got here, I had been here a year, and joke around town was there's two Georgia boys in town, and they both need adult names.
Yeah. we got Bubba coming next, I guess.
That's right. Well, our friendship goes back a long ways. Mm-hmm. Of course, we were older in years when we met each other. And I guess really, I knew you, and you probably knew of me, but really didn't get acquainted until I became president of Georgia Farm Bureau.
That's right.
But I remember right after I got elected, and my world was spinning like it always does when you take a new position. And I was trying to get my hands around what I had just gotten myself into. And I remember that when I was in my office and there in Macon, my secretary said that the governor's people have called you several times and they want to know when they can get a hold of you. So I think you had already called me three times, and the fourth time you got me and you said, "Hey, Zippy," says, "one thing you need to know right now, it's not supposed to be harder to get a hold of the Farm Bureau president than it is the governor."
That's right.
And we both laughed, and our relationship has flourished since then.
So. Well, I think a lot of it had to do with the way we were raised and the way we grew up. Obviously, your experience as a longtime dairyman and mine is growing up in a dairy farm family as well as a diversified row co-op. I think there's something there with the dirt that really bonds you together. You may remember the joke I used to tell about when I was elected governor. People said, "Well, what is a farm kid with a veterinarian and agribusiness career? How does that qualify you to be a governor?" I said, "Well, it's pretty simple. Already got the boots, the glove, and the shovel." And you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
There from the dairy business.
Yeah. Well, mentioning your background, I mean, I think our background is what developed us as,
sure,
as men, as businessmen, as family men, mm-hmm, and as spiritual men. And I'd like for you to just kind of tell us what's happened in your background that's led you to be secretary of the United States of America?
Well, first of all, I never thought I'd be here, never aspired to this job, but obviously God had different plans for us, and never really aspired to be governor or any in political position at all. In fact, I remember my first civic service public works job was on planning and zoning in Houston County. If you remember, the county's in Georgia. Houston was a rapidly transitioning from agrarian to suburbanizing, industrializing, commercializing county. And the commissioners appointed me and they said, you don't have any political ambitions, do you? I said, no. They said, good, with this job, you won't need any. But frankly, it turned out to be, Zippy, the best that job I could have is training to listen to people and listen to their heartbeat, to their passion, of their personal property, personal community good, and those kind of things. So it was great, great training. But I think the lessons I learned, the Bible talks about the law of the land and the things that you learn growing up on a farm for doing things decently in order. I say often today, you can't plant in August and harvest in September. You have to do things decently and in order. And there's a method to what you have to do. I think it trains you. I like to think about, I call it now, the blessings of purposeful, meaningful work. When you grow up on a farm, you either do it or it doesn't get done, or you have to hire somebody else to do it. From the very early time feeding those calves and moving on forward and milking and everything else, as well as running tractors and putting up silage, all those kind of things mold you, I think, into a goal-oriented type of accomplished work mentality. It was, I just call it whatever it takes. That's right. What you have to do on a farm. That's what farmers and ranchers do every day. It's whatever it takes. They don't have any set hours. They don't have any set jobs. It's just whatever it takes.
Yeah. So the next step in our life took us to a little different level. And I spent 30 years dairying, and I know you had some time growing up dairying and being a veterinarian. I think one of the stints you did was military stint that I didn't experience. And, as you get older, you wish you would have given that time as a person that haven't done that. But my next stint took me to be president of Georgia Farm Bureau. And that's where I always knew this, and my dad taught me this, but that's where I really discovered the value of relationships and building relationships with people that have different views or have different missions. And how do you work not in changing them, but how you work with that personality or that relationship to make something good happen for other people that we serve? So tell me some of the stories that you might experience in your next step as governor.
Well, my path took me to the state senate. I had no ambition really over elected office, but a state senator who had been in office in our area for 18 years decided rather late in the qualifying cycle he wasn't going to run again. And I'd been serving on planning and zoning for about 10 years. And they came and said, would you run for this? I said, well, no, I don't care to run for it. They said, well, what do you think about it? I said, I'll think about it, but the answer is no. But as it would have it, Mary and I had already planned a vacation to Williamsburg, Virginia. And we got up there and walked those dusty streets of really the founding of this nation, a citizen legislature coming out from your fields and farms and businesses and coming together to do the public work and go back home. And we had a citizen legislature in Georgia, so in 2-year terms. So Mary and I, right about that, we decided that we would offer ourselves, and we got elected to the state senate there in 1990.
Some of the people that I have worked with since I became president of Georgia and now American have become very, very good friends, and I'm sure you're one of those special friends that I've made.
Well, Zippy, you've traveled all over the country as I have, and we've traveled together a lot of times. I was there for the first year or so. I think I was either following you or you were following me. We were in lockstep, just maybe at different times together. But what I found is that I don't think you nor I could serve a better constituency. I tell people, north, south, east, or west, farm folks are just so much alike. Yeah. They're really the I think the spirit of Americana, the work ethic, the faith, the family. I think farming and ranching drives you to your knees. I remember, you remember those droughts we had in Georgia?
Yeah.
Drove us to our knees there and in that, and because we need it. And I think the fact that what farm families depend on, ranchers depend on across this country, builds within them a resilience. It builds in a hope and an optimism you got to be an optimist to farm these days, as you well know.
Again, this was just a portion of that interview between Zippy and Sonny. To listen to the full podcast, visit www.fb.org/podcast. This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now. An American Farm Bureau Federation official says alternative proteins won't disrupt demand for animal agriculture. Michael Clements has this report.
The rise of alternative proteins prompts questions about how the products will impact animal agriculture production and demand. However, Scott Bennett, American Farm Bureau Federation Congressional Relations Director, says alternative proteins are not a threat to conventional meat and diets.
There will always be a demographic of consumers that want and prefer conventional meat. And to be honest, that's most consumers in America. If a consumer wants to try a plant-based protein, by all means, let them try it. Our job here is just to make sure they know exactly what it is they are buying, which is in fact not meat.
Bennett says AFBF supports consumer choice. However, labels cannot be deceptive or misleading.
Alternative proteins are not meat, and that needs to be crystal clear. Look, in my opinion, these products are for a niche market. For most Americans just trying to feed their family, they're headed to the meat counter to pick up their next meal.
Bennett says it's important to stay focused on growing the protein market.
We tend to get caught up on the small slice of the pie of the market share that these alternative proteins are capturing. I would rather us focus on growing the size of the pie. That benefits more diets globally and still allows for that consumer choice. And American producers of protein are first in line to benefit from that growth.
Michael Clements, Washington.
And in more agriculture news, the Agriculture Secretary recently used a visit to the Badger State to discuss a USDA program and illustrate the importance of educating students on agriculture. USDA's Rod Bain has this report.
Part of Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue's recent Wisconsin itinerary involves stops to make the connection between farm.
It's a great experience to be here on a real farm in Wisconsin. We kind of did a preliminary apple crunch.
And school.
Fifth graders that I had lunch with, it was kind of farm to school day, as well as the fuel up to play 60 with the NFL, and understanding that good nutrition and good activity go together for a healthy kid and healthy adults as well.
And the secretary, while talking to reporters at a Wisconsin apple farm, explained why USDA's farm to school program and similar offerings are significant for all ages.
It's important for kids to know where our food comes from. We're two or three or sometimes four generations from any relative being on the farm these days, and it's really important for kids to know what it takes to grow their healthy food. And this is a great example right here, apples and pumpkins and raspberries right here. It's important for kids to get out here or either learn about it in schools. Our producers need to go into the schools and talk about that.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can follow AgNet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgNetWest. Follow Brian German with @BrianAgNetWest, Danielle Leal with @DLealAgNetWest, and Taylor Hillman with @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City News Day by AgNet West.